Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. This week, Jamie joins me for a grab bag of topics. We are midway through the ATP Finals, so hard to make any definitive conclusions there, but we can talk about the matches that have been played so far. We'll talk about 2021 tennis and what the picture is looking like. It is slowly coming into focus, but still considerably blurry and uncertain. We'll talk WTA Awards. There are no more women's tennis events on the calendar, but we can start distributing some honors and just sort of a catch-all of tennis topics as we, I don't want to say limp to the finish, but we're not exactly sprinting either. A strange year that is finishing under strange conditions, and we talk about sort of where the sport is here in mid-November 2020. So, Jamie, welcome. It's been a while. How are you?
It's been a while. I'm good. I agree with you. It's a weird year, and I feel like we've been talking a lot about the ATP, and obviously the ATP finals are happening, so I am happy to start by talking about the WTA and some of these awards.
All right, let's go there. Let's do that first. That's a good idea. Let's go to, the WTA does not, unlike the ATP, the WTA does not have a finals for 2020, unfortunately. That's an offshoot of having events in China where international sporting events were canceled months ago. So the men are playing as we speak in London, and there is no there is no comparable women's event. So let's do that. Let's start with the women's season's over. Why don't we hand out some awards, and then we can pivot to London. MVP award is always a bit strange, but if we're going to give player of the year honors, I feel like the player has to have won a major. Do you agree with that?
Yes, definitely agree with that. But this year, of course, we had one less. And I think that I would also classify the majors into pre-corona and post-corona. I would almost give a little bit more weight, or just feel like there's more discussion for all of the majors that are not the Australian Open. You know, of course, that was when all was normal and before all of this happened. But I know you went through your picks in your mailbag, but who's your pick?
I think, it sounds a little funny. I think you've got to say that Sonia Kenin is your 2020 MVP. She won a major and got to the final of another. If we play this game sometime, if your life depended on a player, would she be your pick? And the answer, is probably not. And do I think in a head-to-head match there are players who are superior? If she and Naomi Osaka played 10 times, I would think Naomi Osaka would win the majority of those matches. But yeah, in this strange year, I mean, I think you're right. There was no Wimbledon. There was a U.S. Open, but it did not feature, six of the top 10 players, including Ash Barty, the number one player, including
Simona Halep, including the defending champion. And that was won by Osaka. Then we had the French Open, which also did not feature Ash Barty, who is the defending champion. It did not feature Naomi Osaka. The Australian Open, before Corona, had the most flush field. Sonia Kenin won that, and she reached the final of the French Open. So she's the only player to have won a major and gotten to the final of another. And in this strange year, it's probably appropriate we have a strange choice. But Sofia Kenin is my 2020 MVP. What about you?
I hear you on that, and I think those are all good points. So that we aren't agreeing here on all of these, and there's some interest to this conversation, I'm going to take a different pick. I'm going to go with Naomi Osaka. And I think that in speaking about an MVP, sort of in the light of a lot of awards that are giving out at this time of the year, including SI's own award of Sports Person of the Year, it's not just about what's happening, you know, on the court. It's just not about results per se. It's about other things that this player has done. So I think that for me, I think Naomi Osaka, of course, like you said, Kenin, if you're just talking about reaching a final, winning a final in a major, she's done that. But Osaka has not only won, but also used her platform, and she's spoken up and she's gone beyond the court. And I think that, you know, if you're looking at that list of choices here, and you check the box with a major win, and for me, you check the box with all the other outside stuff off the court that she's done. So that's my pick.
Oh, I like that idea. I think you're right. I think we need to expand criteria this year, especially.
Exactly.
I don't know if you saw, I'm trying to find this. There was a big Ad Age star about a big Ad Age story about Naomi Osaka and how activism has sort of, you know, she filled the space. And I'll try and post this story on our show notes. She also became the highest paid female athlete, the highest income of any female athlete, overtaking Serena Williams. I'm with you on that. I mean, and she won a major decisively. She had her Cincinnati moment when she also reached the final of that event. And I also think I will bolster your point and say that apart from everything she did off court and really, and I think some of this was at the start of the year, you might've said this was out of character. But Naomi Osaka would not have been your number one choice to have emerged as tennis's great advocate and social justice advocate.
Right.
As the year progressed. And I think the fact that it in no way came at a price to her tennis also added to this. I mean, after the moment in Cincinnati, she went on and won the U.S. Open for the second time. So the fact that this activism streak did not seem to have any impact on her tennis, I think is significant too. I'll buy that. So yeah.
I would say also that 2020, I think, and you make a good point about saying at the beginning of this year, I think this was a real growth year for her. I feel like we've talked about this a little bit, but she really seemed to mature on and off the court this year. And I think we saw it happen sort of in real time in many ways, especially over the summer. So I think, if we talk about MVP in terms of just emerging in a certain way, I think like she also gets a nod there too. So
how athlete, activist, and next gen marketing magnate Naomi Osaka aces her brand partnerships. There's a headline, but that's from Adweek. That's from Adweek this week. And I think that sort of in its convoluted way encapsulates it. And I think this year, I mean, someone asked me a question, the digression here, but someone sent in a mailbag question, which I didn't answer yet because I'm still sort of wrestling with it. Was I surprised that Serena Williams was not more vocal? And basically the question essentially said, how did Serena Williams sort of get her activist lunch eaten by Naomi Osaka? How did she get overcome? How did she sort of get surmounted by Naomi Osaka as becoming this voice? And I think, you know, people wear their activism differently, sometimes lightly and sometimes heavily. I think it's very much an individual choice, and it's really perilous to start questioning why people didn't say more or why somebody should have said less. I mean, I think people are processing this strange year and these strange moments individually, and we ought to respect choice. But I think embedded in that question is this idea, and I think it's this is a valid point, that Naomi Osaka is not who you would have picked necessarily, not who you would have predicted to sort of go out there and ignore trolls and speak her mind. And I think you're right. It's interesting if we're sort of, MVP is always one of these ill-defined terms. Player of the year is always one of these ill-defined terms. But I think Naomi Osaka revealed a lot about herself and picked up a third major, which makes her a lock for the Hall of Fame. It's a very significant, strange year for Naomi Osaka. So you've converted me. What about the WTA sort of gave us these categories and right. They're, you never quite know where to draw these dividing lines. I mean, who is a newcomer and who's a player who just maybe was there. They weren't necessarily new, but they elevated their game. I mean, it does seem like if we have this newcomer award, it can't not go to Iga Swiatek, even if this wasn't technically her rookie year. What about in that category?
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about the difference here between newcomer and most improved player. So they have newcomer as a player who made a top 100 debut or some sort of notable accomplishment for the first time, whereas most improved was a player who finished inside the top 50 and showed significant improvement. So I don't know. It's difficult. I don't know why Swiatek is not in the newcomer category as well as the most improved, but I agree with you. I think if this was renamed as sort of a breakout or a breakthrough player, surprise of the year. I mean, we could call it a lot of different things, but I think she hands down wins that.
Agree. I mean, not even close. And I think, here was a player with a very decorated junior career. And as you say, she was in the main draw. I mean, sometimes we see players that have these extraordinary junior careers really struggle with the transition. I mean, it wasn't quite that. I mean, she was in matches and had, played a nice match here and there. But it was at the point where even she was considering how long am I willing to devote myself to this life? And there's plenty other interests I have that I can nourish. And then she just played 2 weeks of absolutely dazzling tennis and never had that moment where that never sort of had that holy shit moment. I'm a few sets from winning a major. I mean, just sustained it throughout and was as dominant in the final against Kennan as she was in her early round matches. Remember she beat Simona Halep and everybody sort of said, well, that's an incredible hour of tennis she played. Let's see if she sustains it. And you know what she did. And I think now the questions quickly became how many more does she have in her, and who's basically this went from boy she's playing well to is this really a new star with some sustaining star power, because that was 14 sets played and 14 sets won, and that was an extraordinary high level of tennis, and to do that for seven matches was quite a state. So these categories are always a little fuzzy, and it's not like conventional sports where you have a rookie class.
Right.
But if this is sort of a catch-all, which star really elevated and had this breakthrough, I think this one's a no-brainer. What about speaking of vague categories and distinctions, what about comeback player of the year? Three of the four choices the WTA gave us: Azarenka, Pironkova, Tig, and the fourth was Laura Siegman. The first three of those are mothers, which I think is interesting and significant, and a different twist that we're used to on comeback, which tends to be a player who's been injured and has a successful return. Who's your winner in the comeback category?
Yeah, the description there has says a ranking that has dropped due to injury or personal reasons. So for the WTA, feels like this can continue to be a category with a lot of mothers in it. But I think I have to go with Azarenka. It's hard not to choose her. She didn't just come back from, her maternity leave this year. So I think that's one point to make. But she almost won another major after being away from that part of the game for so long. And she really just dominated, and we saw flashes of an old player that we hadn't seen in a long time. So if you're talking about comeback and a return, I think that, she defines that for 2020 for sure.
That was my choice as well. And we talk about it all the time in tennis. It's such a mental sport, and then the psychological wear and tear and mental fatigue and spiritual fatigue, and what Victoria Azarenka has gone through in a number of ways, her maternity situation, some bad draws, some really high level of tennis, but then it's dropped in her subsequent match. I mean, she's been through a lot, and to emerge as a player now firmly in the top 20, came a few games away from winning her third major, and seems like sort of a sage. This is a wise woman of women's tennis. I think she's no contest here. She's our comeback player. What about, I'll give you an easy one, which is women's doubles, which really just, I think we can kind of go to the stat sheet on that one.
Yes.
And Kristina Mladenovic and Tamia Babos of Hungary won two of the three majors, and probably should have won a third. I don't know if there's much to discuss there. Let me give you two that were not on the list, which is one of them. Do you have a match of the year? I'll give you mine, and you can agree or disagree. But I would fold in the U.S. Open women's semis: Naomi Osaka, Jen Brady, Serena, and Victoria Azarenka, which was probably a favorite day of tennis in a long time. I mean, just two well-played, high-quality, well-contested matches. I think we ought to tip a cap to Jen Brady. She doesn't necessarily fit tidily into any of the categories, but she ought to come in for some applause with her 2020. Definitely. And that day of, I mean, that's my favorite day of tennis, certainly of the year and of a long time. That was just two back-to-back matches, four players, four different styles, all of them well contested, all of them really high level from a drama standpoint, from a stat sheet standpoint, all the more so given that there wasn't a crowd that could add context. If I had a match of the year, I would expand the category and make it a night of the year.
I like that. I like that. Right. That's good. I was going to actually go to the US Open too. And just go back to Naomi Osaka. I think one of the most powerful things for me was when she, you know, first came out and she just said that she had these seven masks, right? And I, as soon as she said that, you, of course, I immediately, my mind just went to, you know, reading that, fast forwarding, you know, to the end of the tournament and just reading that article that had, a seven mask, seven matches sort of lead to it. And, for me, I think that what was most incredible about her winning in that tournament was that she didn't let that distract her. I think a lot of other players, would have felt that immense pressure to like continue and to, you know, get all seven masks worn and to, you know, really put a stamp on everything she was doing during that time. And so, we talk about Azarenka and everything, and I just think that definitely stands out for me. Also just the fact that tournament in general was, you know, our first major back also just makes it significant.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
You know, about the seven masks, a member of her camp suggested to me that it really wasn't. I mean, it sounds almost like a flex. It sounds sort of like a bit of a statement. I'm going to be here. And the way it was explained to me is that it was almost inadvertent that Naomi Osaka, obviously very moved about the events of the summer. I mean, we should mention she went as a, you know, not a celebrity delegation. I mean, she went as a concerned citizen to Minneapolis to protest George Floyd. And this business of I've worn a mask, each of them adorned with someone else who suffered at the hands of police. This was not done as any sort of statement to the rest of the field. I mean, this was just something she sort of said. The way this was explained to me, this was sort of said offhandedly. And she had these masks made, but it wasn't even meant necessarily as the statement that we all interpreted as. But then, of course, she was able to wear each of those seven as she advanced to the finals and then won in the finals. Again, I mean, I think Naomi Osaka becomes suddenly one of the really intriguing figures in all of sports right now. And she hasn't played since the U.S. Open, but it will be interesting to see what 2020 brings. Let me ask you one more category question, which is almost more a philosophical question than anything else. If Naomi Osaka, or as I had it, Sonia Kenin, is our MVP, can you have a coach of the year as anyone other than that player's coach? If Simona Halep is not your MVP, can Darren Cahill still be your coach of the year? Discuss.
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can switch. I think it makes sense to align with the MVP of the year. But of course, as we just sort of showed, there's a lot of disagreement, and there's, you know, a few players in that conversation for player of the year. I also think that you can look to comeback player or newcomer of the year with Svratek to their coaches and also recognize them, because I think one could argue that a player who is outside of the top 50 or, you know, hasn't been on the Grand Slam stage ever or in a long time needs a lot more work and a lot more coaching to get to the point that they did than a player who perhaps had already been in the top, you know, three rankings or has already won two majors. So I think there's, a devil's advocate argument there. And I would say that perhaps a player who is not as high of a ranking, who has not won a major, may actually have less coaching to do than some of the others. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think one of them is that mid-match coaching is illegal, and I would feel a little funny about giving this award to Sonia Kenin's father just by virtue of how often he is sanctioned for what is a rule infraction. I think I'm also a little – I mean, I always feel like with tennis, you know, it's the player that's out there. And use, you know, Jen Brady as an example. Like, her coach – Michael Gesser clearly has done a nice job with her, and clearly her ranking speaks for itself in that elevation. But let's celebrate Jen Brady. I mean, she's the one that's out there, and she's the one that's alone on the court and hitting the shots and on the treadmill, and in her case, going to Germany during the pandemic and improving on clay. In an individual sport, I feel like we need to devote the most of our devote the majority of our attention on the player that's actually out there getting it done. I also wonder if this is a category that should not be expanded as well. I'd be inclined to give if there's a sports psychologist of the award of the year, Dario Abramowitz, who worked with Svantec and Svantec credited so effusively, is someone who probably comes in for acknowledgement. But the coaching I have a bit of an issue with, sometimes because just the coaches are violating the rules, which is not something – perhaps we ought to be honoring, but also let's give Serena Williams credit, and let's give let's give Andre Rublev credit. Let's not go overboard on the coach, who may play an essential role, but in an individual sport, let's give the actual athlete the majority of the credit.
Idea about honoring sort of the specialty coach, if you will, not just the regular day-to-day coach. I think those types of coaches perhaps deserve some sort of recognition, because of just how whether it's for a specific fitness, whether it's for you know, mental fitness, as you mentioned, I think they do. But as I'm saying this, I will go back to say that it's also on the player themselves to hire that person and to seek out that person. Whereas, you know, maybe in a team setting, that psychologist is someone that's available to the whole team and it's already there. That person has been vetted and hired by a team organization. Whereas, you know, in tennis, that player has to go out and, you know, seek out that person and decide that they need that person, which I think is a really big step. So, I am contradicting myself as I say what I said, but I think it's a really interesting topic overall.
Yeah, you could expand that to, you know, it's Pierre Paganini and Gebhard Grish and Maimo. You could expand that to trainers and other members of the team that play an essential role that we may not necessarily know from watching the player perform on court. All right, let's. So those are our WTA awards. Again, very, very strange year. I think what we're seeing is that in 2020, whether it is tennis, whether it is Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year, whether it's the Nobel Prize that's going to be given out in Stockholm, but streaming live on YouTube in December, strange year for these year-end awards. But, you know, there also were some extraordinary performances and they ought to be acknowledged, which, I mean, I think the pivot here is to men's tennis. And right now in London, we have the ATP Finals. I would submit to you, Jamie, we have a player in Dominic Thiem who won a major and reached the final of another major. We have a player, Novak Djokovic, who won a major and reached the final of another. I would submit to you that if either Thiem or Djokovic wins this event in London, that would tip the balance. So I think it's hard to give an MVP award in men's tennis right now when we still have this important event undecided.
Yes, we shall wait, I guess, another week or so when we return on the podcast and discuss the men's awards. I think we got to wait until the ATP finals are over. But I will say, as someone brought up this topic in your mailbag this week about the ATP finals and just the overall idea of how they feel. And you know, I think someone mentioned that it feels more like an exhibition than anything else. And I know that at this time of year, some people are really into the ATP finals and others don't necessarily see it as a tournament that's similar to a major, just because some people don't decide not to play or maybe because of the format. And you talked about this a little bit, but I'm with you in a sense that I think the ATP Finals has this strange feeling to it. I think the fact that you've got all these players, you know, top players, and they're playing this round robin format, but then also they have to play single elimination after that. It's all very strange, and I do think that some players hold the title, the year end title, higher than others. You know. Of course, if Nadal, I think he's really wanting to win this because it's sort of the one big hole on his resume right now. But for others, we've seen people skip it, you know, because they've already done it and maybe don't want to do it again. So for me, this is always such an interesting tournament. But this year, given the fact that we did not play tennis all year and we had this interruption and this time off, I think I might hold a little bit more value to it this year because these players haven't played and maybe this acts as that fourth major. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's, you know, even in a conventional year, as you say, it's always been a bit of a strange event for me. I mean, on the one hand, it's these are the eight best players, and if you had to somehow norm matches for ranking of the opponent, this would be an extraordinary event. I mean, you literally don't play a match against anyone outside the top 10. And that's in and of itself extraordinary. I think the surface is always a little bit strange. I mean, this is an indoor event, mostly based on time of year. Well, there are no majors played indoors. So on the one hand, it's this democratic surface. It makes for good tennis, but it's a little strange that you're seeing these matches played on a surface on which none of the four biggest events are played. And I'm always hung up by this round robin. And I think one thing that really makes tennis special, it's maddening if you run a tournament. It's maddening if you have a financial stake in this. But this win or go home, this survive and advance, single elimination, every match matters because there's no way to play a crappy round of golf on Thursday and make it up on Friday and make the cut. I mean, in a conventional event, the fact that every match could be your exit, I think is really significant. I mean, you get to the third set and it's 4-all, and it's basically you're 8 points from going back to the locker room and packing your bags and getting a flight out of town, or you advance. And when that is absent, when you have these round robin matches and you have Djokovic lost, but he could advance if X, Y, and Z happens, it just changes the whole vibe. And, you know, this year especially, it's the last year in London. There are no fans here. The rankings are in a strange position. Roger Federer is not there. I mean, it's not your conventional year-end event, but I think even in the best of years, it's always been a strange event to me. On the other hand, it's often furnished some terrific tennis. It's always interesting to me which players in November still have, still have some gas in the tank, which players are finishing strong. And it's a real statement about durability to play at a high level and win tight matches in November after this interminable season. And it's also, you know, I think it's a little vulgar, but this also is a big moneymaker for both of the tours. I mean, even early this summer, I was being told that basically the ATP was going to finish, with a profit, provided London happens, and it was going to be a loss year if London were canceled. I'm not sure quite how the math is going to break, given that London is happening, but without a single ticket being sold. But no, it's a strange event. I mean, the tours rely on these events in a lot of ways, these are the biggest line item in the budgets. And sometimes the tennis is brilliant. Sometimes the tennis is not brilliant. Sometimes you have players playing half-heartedly because of this round robin format. But I think this year, it's sort of, in some ways it's especially strange, and in some ways it's especially significant because, again, I think players are playing for a lot. And I think if Novak Djokovic were to win this, it would be a real statement, and he would be our 2020 MVP. If Dominic Thiem were to win it, same thing for him. I mean, that match against Nadal was one of the best matches I've seen in recent memory. But these year-end finals are always a bit strange, despite the fact that you have an unprecedented field. I mean, there's no other event that has top players and no one else, and no easy matches and no buys and no qualifiers. I mean, it's in some ways a very extraordinary event, and in some ways the round robin makes it feel a little strange for me. So that's my filibuster. let's quickly talk some other topics real quick as we wait for these matches. I mean, right now, as we record this, Dominic Thiem is playing against Andre Rublev. So this is these are all live issues, and I don't want to make this too obsolete. Do you have thoughts? One of the sort of non-tennis stories here is Sasha Zverev and these allegations that continue to dog him. We've talked about this in a number of contexts. Do you have, I don't know if you and I have talked about this. You have thoughts on this, the Zverev situation?
Yeah, we've touched on this a lot in the mailbag. And I think the fact that the ATP has made a statement finally, that was sort of something on my mind that was frustrating. And as you, talked about in your mailbag and you talked about on the podcast with Ben Rothenberg, I think, you know, it's really different from how other sports would handle this. And I just, the whole situation is very unfortunate, and truly I wish that Zverev handled it in a different way. You know, I feel like this year at the US Open, we really thought, okay, wow, like, you know, he's there, and he actually had, you know, a real chance to win that title, and he didn't, but he was there, and maybe this is sort of the breakthrough where, you know, next time he finally wins that first major title. But For me, this just shows that he is not, maturity wise, he's just not there yet. And he's just not, you know, I look to guys like Federer and Nadal that have really shown such a just maturity, but also the way that they handle themselves inside the game, outside the game, with other players. There's just a this general respect that we understand, that we see from the other players. And at one point, I know that Federer had sort of taken Zverev under his wing, or they had, you know, these conversations. And I thought that that had maybe helped him in certain ways. But again, for me, this just shows me that he's not there yet. And I think these allegations are very serious. And I kind of don't like that he's playing while this is all sort of up in the air and being investigated. So for me, that makes it hard to watch him, you know, it gives the ATP finals just a strange, even more of a strange feeling than normal.
It's, you know, it's an unpleasant fact pattern, to put it mildly, to start with. I mean, I think you're right. I think one of the real issues here is that there's just no policy, and the ATP's statement, I don't think necessarily helps matters. I mean, the idea that sort of everyone's hamstrung until there's some legal activity, until charges are filed, that seems to me both cowardly and also at odds with a certain reality, which is there are reasons why women who are abused don't call police. There are a lot of times when women decide that for a variety of reasons, they're not eager to cooperate with law enforcement. I think in this case, you know, it's the middle of a pandemic. Resources are finite. You have a player not based in the U.S. You have an alleged victim not based in the U.S. There are reasons why this would not necessarily trigger a criminal complaint or an investigation from New York authorities. That doesn't necessarily, you know, I don't think that necessarily exonerates anyone. I do have some sympathy for Zverev in the sense that you're faced with these questions. I mean, I remember in law school, you sort of have this, when did you stop having an extramarital affair? I mean, there are questions that become very hard to answer. And, you know, there are a limited number of responses he could have. It would be nice if he acknowledged the severity. It would be nice if he acknowledged generically that he is repulsed by any allegation of domestic violence. I mean, all of his responses have been very sort of narcissistic and me-centered, and I'm not sure it's a great look to have him, you know, looking at his notes app or reading his phone. At the same time, you know, this is a serious allegation. These are serious charges with serious impact on his career. It's understandable why he would want to play it pretty close to the vest. But I mean, I think the big problem here is just that there's no real policy. I mean, I think a policy would, I think it's the right thing to do. I think it would make the tour's job easier that they could point to something and not have these ad hoc statements, but it also a firm policy would help Zverev in that he would know what the expectations were. He would know a timetable. As it stands now, we just seem to sort of be at this stalemate where no one appears like they're going to do anything until there's actual legal activity, until they're actual charges or a police investigation. I don't think that's necessarily likely. I mean, the alleged victim has already said that she doesn't want that. So, you know, if you're the Southern District of New York or if you're the NYPD, it's the middle of a pandemic, you're going to have to fly across ocean to have an in-person interview. I'm not sure, you know, realistically charges are going to come from this, but I don't think that necessarily ought to foreclose any other investigation I think that's pretty soft. I mean, we can think of a number of cases in a number of other sports where there's been suspension and investigation, even when there hasn't been a formal police report. But no, I mean, I think it's deeply unfortunate. I think it's going to be something very hard for Zverev to recover from. I mean, these are very serious, specific allegations. I think you're right. You mentioned Federer and Nadal, and you sort of go down and expand this, and it's Murray and Djokovic. And I mean, every star player on the women's tour as well. I mean, it's very rare that we've seen a star player in tennis have to deal with something like this mid-career. So I think a lot of people are sort of caught flat-footed, that bad behavior in tennis usually means something, a point penalty is the punishment. It's not something where we're waiting for criminal charges to be filed. So anyway, it seems to me we're sort of at a standstill, and it becomes incumbent on fans and sponsors. We keep talking about this Adidas deal. At some level, the tours. At some level, it'll be interesting to see what the reception is when Zverev plays a live match. It'll be interesting to see what the reception is when there's a joint event and his female colleagues he'll have to interact with. The media has a role in this. I mean, it's just going to be interesting. It seems like we're at a standstill in terms of the fact pattern. It's just going to be interesting to see sort of, you know, to what extent people pursue this informally and to what extent this fades away. But it's ugly stuff. And those were serious, specific allegations with other people weighing in, and the initial Instagram account. She then went further with Ben Rothenberg, who spoke to her face to face. I said this in print, and I think I said this to Ben too. I mean, it's wrongheaded to think this is he said, she said. I mean, this is not a coin flip. So anyway, it's unfortunate, but I'm not sure what more we can really add at this point. Novak Djokovic is apparently trying to rejoin the ATP board. Heard different variations of this. This, of course, a few months after he resigned from the board along with Bacik Pospisil and founded the PTPA, which had a fairly dramatic photo and press conference during the U.S. Open on the eve of the tournament at the grandstand, but never really seemed to have done much since. So now I've heard two different variations of this. One is sort of a big tent in the ATP trying to explain to Djokovic that some of his concerns, which they share as well, are best addressed working in the tent and not outside the tent. We'll see how this pans out. And then, Jamie, real quick, I just think, I hope this will be dated by the time people listen to it. It will be obsolete. But right now, in the last 24 hours, it does seem like there are some complications in terms of the Australian Open 2021. I don't know if you have thoughts on that or saw the memo.
Yeah, so the memo is that there will be no traveling to Australia in December, correct?
Yes, essentially, yeah. And while a 14-day quarantine still remains on the books. So
talking about, that these players might have to spend Christmas, you know, or go over in mid-December so that they have time to not only have the, you know, do the quarantine period, but also get ready for any lead up tournaments in Australia. And then of course the Australian Open seems like it's not going to happen. And I guess now the lead up tournaments themselves are in question because they are not going to be spread around the country as they normally would be, but concentrated. And the travel restrictions are still a question, and I think the fact that cases are rising in other areas while in Melbourne and Australia they have really flattened, and I don't think they've had any new cases in quite a few weeks, so that's a little concerning for me ahead of the Australian Open, just given the fact that it always comes so quickly. I mean, January 1st, we're playing tennis again, you know, and I just don't know if that's going to happen, given that we're in late November here, and now we're not even sure if we can travel to Australia until January 1st.
This is in keeping with the times, but a lot of people seem to have been caught by surprise with this with announcement. And look, I mean, health and safety and the virology comes first. As you say, Melbourne hasn't had a positive test in 3 weeks. And they seem to be, there's a level of social trust and public trust, and there's a spirit of like, we need to deal with this virus before we start talking about marketing and commerce and lockdowns. I think it's going to be very hard optically if special exceptions are made for an international tennis tournament. Someone made the point that, you know, there are Australian citizens who are stranded throughout the world who aren't able to return home on account of this COVID protocol. It's going to be a little strange if Andre Rublev and Dominic Thiem are allowed to get to Australia before actual citizens. At the same time, the Australian Open has gone ahead with plans, and I've friends in Melbourne who will we be seeing you at the tennis, implying that they will be there. So I do think that this has caught a lot of people by surprise, in the sense everyone thought the Australian Open was good to go. I mean, just to sort of clear up and take these off the table, the Australian Open cannot get moved. It will not be played at the Indian Wells Tennis Garden. My strong suspicion is that it will still happen, and there will be maybe some quarantine. So somebody had raised the point, an agent had actually texted me and said, do you think they could even quarantine during the tournament? Which seems to me a little at odds with the idea of a quarantine, but there may be some fancy footwork in terms of timing. I mean, initially the quarantine players were going to be consigned to hotel rooms. They were still going to be able to practice and go to facilities during this December quarantine. Other events, first 2 weeks of the year are likely imperiled, but if my math is right, there's still a way for this all to happen. But this clearly was not what Tennis Australia was expecting. They've been pretty good, it seems, staying in communication with players and managers and agents. But everyone was sort of, listen, I had an airline ticket to, people have told me this. They said, look, I had my whole travel plan made to go to Australia in mid-December, and now that's all changed. The plus side with Tennis Australia was quick to note was players can now spend the holidays at home, and they don't have to worry about having Christmas dinner at a Marriott. But it's been a strange announcement. But I do think Australia's record on COVID speaks for itself, and if this is going to preserve health and safety of a country, it's a little hard to clamor too loudly for tennis tournaments.
Definitely can't argue with that.
All right, let's we are running up against our hour here. In coming weeks we'll have another guest. We will also do our men's year-end awards. We'll have some results from this last ATP finals held at the O2 in London, and hopefully we'll have some happier news about tennis in 2020. If nothing else, we should have some more clarity about the 2021 Australian Open. Jamie, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Good chatting with you.
You as well. We'll do it again next week. Thanks everyone for listening, and keep the guest suggestions coming. Subscribe, leave a review, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good week, everyone, and we'll do it again after Thanksgiving. We'll be right back.